and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your phone calls and emails about healthcare issues and commentaries that you'd like to make. So welcome and stay tuned, I hope, for the next hour. It takes all of us, it takes a village to make this program. Before we go any further, I do need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I have a lot of wonderful emails this week to start off with. Let's start with one from the Philippines. This is from Abigail. I am Abigail, a fourth-year physics student, and I'd like to ask about the depth dose in chest x-ray procedure. When a patient isn't bombarded with X radiation in a chest x-ray, they absorb some of the radiation, which is quantified as a dose. I'm curious if that radiation dose is really as safe as everyone assures us it is. Abigail, I'm curious about that too, and I think that we can apply a certain logic here in the sense that if chest x-rays by themselves were very dangerous, I think we would have figured it out just on the basis of an increased prevalence that would have shown up statistically for perhaps lymph node cancer or lung cancer. And in fact, we didn't see that over the last, we've got 75 years of data now at least. Now, radiation doses are expressed as millisieverts, and the typical effective dose of a single chest x-ray is felt to be about 0.02 or 2/100ths of a millisievert. And we have a daily background dose of radiation, and that's how people kind of compare things. They say, well, you know, a chest x-ray is equivalent to what kind of a natural background radiation. And the natural background radiation in the United States is thought to be about 3 millisieverts. That would be different, of course, if you have a lot of radon-producing gas in your basement. But for most of us, at least, we could sort of take that as something that our bodies are adapted to handle. And I want to take a moment talking about that adaptation. The main problem with radiation is DNA repair. The very first single cellular organisms from which we are ultimately descended had to solve the problem of DNA damage. And this occurred, and there are actually, in the course of cellular division, there's actually a resting phase, which is there for DNA repair. During cell division, the S2 phase is where you do your DNA repair. And that is variable. The cell can actually slow that phase down or turn that phase up, so to speak, and allow more time for DNA repair. And in fact, some of the genes that we associate with cancers are genes that inhibit the prolongation of the DNA repair phase. In other words, the DNA gets damaged, and the DNA that gets damaged is the DNA that puts the pause button on during cellular division to allow for fixing of the transcription errors. So oddly enough, if you mess up that gene, you end up with cancer. Really not so much of a surprise. We have to think in terms of that radiation dose, the millisieverts, however, as maybe working for a chest x-ray because the dose is small and, you know, we said 0.02 millisieverts. And so we're talking about maybe 2 days of background radiation. And that's not so bad. Okay, a couple days of background radiation. Our adaptive mechanisms are probably good enough to handle that. The real issue, and I do think it is a significant issue, is when you start talking about things like CT scans. The radiation dose there is on the order of, like, for example, an abdominal CT is about 3 years of background radiation. And I don't think we know for sure that the repair mechanisms in all of us are going to be able to handle 3 years worth of radiation in one swell swoop. Let me put it in a drug analogy to make it clearer. We love drug analogies in medicine. That's all we think about is drugs. If I were to take 1 acetaminophen, 500 milligrams a day for 6 months, my body would be able to handle that no problem. On the other hand, if I were to take 150 500 milligram pills, in other words, a 6-month dose all at once, I'd probably be committing suicide. I'd certainly be risking complete liver meltdown. That's because the repair mechanisms wouldn't be able, effectively, this is an analogy, to handle it fast enough. So in reference to your question, Abigail, and thank you very much for it, I think that chest x-rays, I believe that there is adequate evidence just in the absence of severe complications. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that everyone who got a physical got a chest x-ray every year, to say that our bodies are capable of handling that much. By the way, another thing that will give you a dose of 0.02 millisieverts is flying from New York to L.A. And so we have a cohort that's been well studied, which is airline pilots and flight attendants. And we do see a slight increase in breast cancer rates in that group. So you might argue that there's enough background radiation to maybe be stimulating the breast. Of course, there are other confounds there, smoking and other behaviors that might be present at a higher rate in flight attendants. And I'm not sure that's ever been adequately controlled for in the epidemiological studies. But nevertheless, it does raise a suspicion that maybe there is an achievable threshold dose above which we're actually running the risk of DNA damage. That being said, don't get a CT scan unless you need it. But I think routine x-rays are probably at a low enough dose that realistically, our biology had to be able to deal with sunspot activity and the increased cosmic rays that came from that, or we wouldn't be here. The next email I want to do is one from Yosemite, actually. This is Deborah in Yosemite. And the subject is, friend needs a systemic approach. My friend has been having problems with her menstrual cycle for the past year or so, and she's not had success in her attempts to control it. She's 36 years old, overweight, although not diabetic. She's a yo-yo dieter, and she was recently found to have hypothyroidism. Her main problem has been excessive bleeding for long periods of time, perhaps even as much as 4 weeks of bleeding with her menses. She was advised to use birth control pills to manage her excessive bleeding, and a week after she started the birth control pills, she was rushed to the hospital with a pulmonary embolism. She had to spend 4 days in the hospital treating this blood clot problem and is now on warfarin. She's concerned about the interaction of warfarin, that's Coumadin, and vitamin K, and she is very confused about her dietary restrictions. Oh boy, what a mess is my first thought here. So let's start with pulling the vitamin K and warfarin piece apart, because I think that is a really important thing to address. And I think it's a very wrong-headed bit of advice that many patients are given, because they're told that because many fruits and vegetables contain vitamin K, and vitamin K reverses the effects of warfarin, that they should avoid eating fruits and vegetables. Well, yes, that's one way to deal with the warfarin issue, but I consider it to be absolutely foolish, because the benefits of the fruits and vegetables are extremely important, and to leave those out of your diet in an attempt to allow yourself to manage a drug, I think, is just the wrong way to go. What I do, on the contrary, is I advise my patients that they are going to need to eat the same number of servings of fruits and vegetables every day of their life while they're on the Coumadin or the warfarin. So pick a number. My preference, 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, because that's what we know helps with high blood pressure, helps with cancer. And, you know, I don't want my patients getting high blood pressure and cancer, so I'm not going to tell them not to eat the fruits and vegetables. But they need to be consistent. So what does that mean? Well, it may mean that at the end of the day, if you've chowed down on the chips and haven't had your vegetables, that you have to throw a bunch of vegetables in the blender and blend up a shake and drink that down before you go to sleep that night. You know, it's really not that big a deal. You can manage this. People who are on warfarin need to be careful about consistency. When they start a new drug, they need to check and make sure it hasn't affected their warfarin levels. So it's a commitment and it's an inconvenience, but at the moment, it is still the standard of care for dealing with blood clot issues. Now, of course, this woman is going to have to not use birth control pills in the future, and that's going to create a problem as far as her bleeding issues. And really, really, the yo-yo dieting and the overweight are probably really at the root of her problem. And this is a patient who I would sit down with and I would put on a diet control program and a support program. This is someone who would need to invest some time and energy in good nutrition and regular exercise. And if that meant anteing up for a personal trainer, or if that meant finding a job that was physical or whatever. But the point is, and I'm speaking to your friend here, Deborah, your life is at stake. You're only 36. You really don't want to be diabetic and fighting breast cancer at 56. And you can completely turn this around, but good nutrition and good dieting are going to be a part of that. Another thing that's going to be a big part of that is controlling the menstrual cycles. And it may be necessary to use, for example, for a while, a progesterone IUD. And for someone who's having this kind of bleeding, who can't use estrogen in a birth control pill form, a progesterone-containing IUD might be a real godsend in terms of managing that aspect of things. So I hope that's been helpful, and I want to thank you for a really excellent question that covered a lot of topics. Let's do another email, and this one from Bill in Scotts Valley, a local guy. Dear Dr. Don, my uncle, with whom I share the same genetically linked high cholesterol, has managed his cholesterol for over 15 years with niacin. He takes no statin drugs. He also takes Metamucil daily. My mother and sister both have high cholesterol similar to my own, with a total count of 265 to 290 if left unchecked. My maternal grandmother died of a stroke at age 59, so we're all looking for safe, effective measures to combat this premature life ender. In a column online, a doctor... This is at Health Central Myths and Facts. A doctor generally prescribes doses of 100 milligrams twice a day of niacin, along with either aspirin or ibuprofen to mitigate flushing for the first week or two. WebMD, another site, is not as bullish on niacin improving cholesterol counts as much as lowering triglycerides level. Both claim dramatic cholesterol-lowering effects when niacin is combined with a statin drug. I'm taking 10 milligrams of Lipitor, and my total cholesterol is about 210, with a decent 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 ratio of LDL to HDL. Could niacin minus the Lipitor reduce my cholesterol to roughly this level? And do you think there's any added effect from the Metamucil? Well, Bill, I want to start off by commenting that niacin has been very much in the news lately, and I'll come back to that. With respect to niacin, yes, alas, its major effect is to lower triglycerides and raise the HDL, which is beneficial, definitely, in cases of high cholesterol. With respect to the anti-inflammatory effects, niacin is not a direct anti-inflammatory the way your Lipitor is. And many cardiologists feel that it is the anti-inflammatory effect of the statins that lowers the event rate in the studies, and not, in fact, the cholesterol-lowering effect. The cholesterol, in other words, may be a marker, but it isn't necessarily the whole story, whatever is the whole story as far as that's concerned. If your uncle is managing his cholesterol with niacin, then I find that very interesting, and you should find out what his dose is. If you can tolerate a high dose of niacin, and indeed flushing and diarrhea are issues, doses up to 3,000 milligrams of immediate-release niacin and up to 2,000 milligrams of an intermediate-release niacin have been shown to be safe and effective. And again, it's if tolerated, because you don't want to make yourself sick trying to control something that is not even a symptom of a disease. It's a marker for a disease process. If you're on anything to lower your cholesterol, in my opinion, it needs to be neutral in terms of any side effects. It doesn't have to be budget neutral, but it needs to be quality of life neutral. So back to niacin. You could stop your cholesterol-lowering statin and try going up on niacin, see what kind of results you can get, and compare them to the effects on the Lipitor. And I would encourage you to take maybe a couple of months and try the experiment. You may find that you can't tolerate the niacin, and then it's a moot point. Or you may find that the niacin does work well for you to lower your cholesterol. And to that I would say, the statements that you see on WebMD and on Health Central, these are based on research. This is research on a herd of wild-type humans, not lab rats who are all genetically very, very similar. You and your uncle are more genetically similar, and it's possible that the variant of high cholesterol that you and your uncle both carry could be one that responds more to niacin than is the typical amount that would be shown in an average study of wild-type humans. So it's worth the experiment. But again, it doesn't necessarily give you the anti-inflammatory effect. And so getting that cholesterol number down is just that. You've got a number on a page. Whether you have the long-term health benefits is another question. And I do want to point out, in terms of the combination of niacins and statins, that's dangerous enough that if you have a cholesterol of 210, your LDL is below 130, I wouldn't go there. I wouldn't take the risk for the liver damage or the rhabdomyolysis with numbers that were that good. I don't think that the increased benefit merits the risk. We're going to Nicole in Gilroy. Hello, Nicole, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm almost 48 years old, and I have a IUD, a 10-year IUD that I've had installed inside of me for almost 12 years now.
What kind of IUD? Is it a copper IUD?
I don't know. That was a long time ago. It was Kaiser. Just, you know, it worked. They never got pregnant on it. So.
They gave you a little card when they gave it to you. You don't have that card any longer?
No.
Okay. Well, go ahead. What's your question?
So I am relying on that still for birth control, and when I went to my gynecologist recently, they said there are no studies to see what its efficacy would be after the 10 years, and I've tried taking the birth control many times in the last 30 years and have never been able to do that because it makes me very ill, and those symptoms I get from taking the birth control are the same ones that I get from time to time when I'm on my period, which makes for a very, very painful period in that my stomach loads up, not necessarily with fluid, but with gas. And so then that makes me start to think that there's something related between my intestinal system and my reproductive system, and I get very confused. But the bottom line is that I'm in so much pain, and it's just no fun. And I it's been suggested to me that substances such as paraben and makeup and whatnot are exacerbating those symptoms, and then also I'm aware of the effects of the full moon, that perhaps that with this last full moon that's what made this one particularly bad for me, and I'm just wondering if there's I just don't know how to make it better, and I just don't like living 1 week of each month like this.
All right, so if I understand correctly, Nicole, the issue is, there's two issues. One is, you know, you have an IUD that's now, you're in the brave new world of experimenting in sense of, we don't know how effective that IUD is going to be. I will say that probably the original IUDs actually did not have copper in them. The original IUDs were just foreign bodies that affected the inside of the uterus. And then later on, the copper was added and the IUD was made smaller. And now the copper ones and the progesterone one are the only ones that are out there. But given the fact that the original IUDs actually were not copper, the fact that your copper is gone, or let's say no longer validated scientifically, doesn't really mean that it isn't going to work for you. But you're on your own. I mean, there's no data. And when you're in a situation with no data, I would prefer to see you change out that IUD. Now, you're 48 years old, so your probability of pregnancy is low. If your periods are heavy, it might make sense to switch to one of the progesterone-containing IUDs if you still have health insurance.
That's my question, in that I don't know if it's the progesterone in the birth control pill that has caused my inability to take it or what. And if it is, I, you know, can't.
Well, let me stop you and just ask, do you have health insurance?
Yes.
Okay. So you
that's the birth, the IUD is not covered.
The IUD is not covered. Okay, that's an important bit of data, because obviously if it was covered, the smart move would be switch IUDs, use the progestin one, and then if your symptoms flare, yank the IUD and go to a diaphragm. And at your age, probably a diaphragm is going to be sufficient for prevention of pregnancy. That would be the simple advice, but of course, nothing is ever simple, right?
The IUD causes symptoms.
Well, it sounds like you had them when you were on the pill, too. And the IUD that you have in does not have progesterone in it, because they didn't exist 12 years ago. So we know that. So the symptoms have occurred with and without the IUD. So no, I don't think the IUD is causing them. Could it be exaggerating cramping? Yeah, that's one of the known side effects. But you should have been able to figure that out, because your cramping would have gotten a lot worse after you had the IUD inserted.
Right. And no, it didn't. And in fact, my periods were better for many years. Mm-hmm. It's just in the last year or so that they've been progressively bad.
Right.
So,
and I, first of all, I think that the first thing I would probably try in a patient like yourself, I would make sure you had a normal pap smear and that you didn't have a low-grade chlamydia infection or something that, that could be fueling this, and so you'd get an exam. Then I would order an ultrasound looking for fibroids. I would make sure that the IUD was still inside the uterus and it wasn't trying to migrate into the muscle. And if all of those things were cool, then I would try having you use ibuprofen, leading your period by about, or your symptoms by a couple of days. So you have a regular cycle, you know that you're going to bleed on the 14th, so on the 11th you start taking maybe 600 milligrams of ibuprofen or 500 milligrams of naproxen twice a day. And you try to block the generation of prostaglandins in the uterus, because what happens towards the end of the cycle is your uterus elaborates these compounds called prostaglandins that cause the uterus, which isn't in fact a muscle, to contract. And the contraction is there to shake loose the endometrial lining and cause you to have a bleed, which is good. But they also are chemical substances, and they diffuse through the belly, and they actually can have an influence on the bowel. Many of my patients will have constipation or some other disturbance of their bowel function around that last week of their period. Very common. And so blocking the prostaglandins proactively may actually shift your symptoms to the level of manageability without doing anything more aggressive.
Oh, that makes sense, and I really appreciate that. And that's the first time that anyone's ever really tied the whole system together for me.
You're welcome.
Because I've never been able to, you know, I thought they were all separate, but, you know, we have one body that holds everything together.
Yeah, so and things diffuse, and that's important. I want to mention about the parabens, because I do think that that is a potential issue, but it's an issue in the way that the plastic water bottles are an issue. It's a low-level hormone mimic, low-level being a key phrase here. So if you are at a critical period of your development, like you're an infant or you're going through puberty, where there's a lot of shifts going on hormonally, it's more likely, if there is any risk associated, and we really haven't established that. What we've established is that parabens will influence estrogen receptors at a very low level. And what that means and whether it's really a danger, we don't know. It's just spooky. It's scary. Just like the thing with the bisphenol A is scary, and the thing with the phthalates and the little boys born with the anogenital distance being shorter on the average. It's like, you know, that and the fish with multiple genitalia, you start to wonder if we're actually messing with stuff we don't understand. And the answer I would say for you at 48 is, yes, probably, but not what I would consider to be your big issue. And I don't think that, you know, going with paraben-free makeup is going to make one iota of difference in your menstrual cycles. It's at a different level of problems.
Can you tell me again what the name of that substance is that causes the contraction pains inside the uterus?
Prostaglandin. P-R-O-S-T-O. Prosta. I think it's prosta. Aglandin. And gland like gland, and then I-N.
Because, you know, I do, it's like I'm in contraction labor.
Yeah.
I'm going to deliver.
Yeah, and I do mean it about the ultrasound. You have a look at that and see if you've got a big old fibroid. Okay.
All right.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the call. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, while we were on the subject of niacin, bringing it back around to Bill's email, another one from Claire in Castroville. Dear Dr. Don, on November 8th, you mentioned the use of niacin supplements to treat peripheral circulation problems. I've looked online for the articles, but have not found any that are very definitive. Would you be so kind as to direct me to the information you cited? Also, I've stumbled on information that links dietary niacin with the prevention of Alzheimer's. Is there any evidence that supplementary niacin will slow the process of dementia? My mother has both of these and other health complications, not diabetes, but I would want her doctor to recommend any niacin treatment. Specific articles might encourage her to at least ask about it. Well, let me start with the information about using niacin for peripheral vascular issues was for cold feet and cold hands. Well, that's a combination of lore and the known side effects of the drug. The drug causes, as a side effect, flushing. And flushing can be good if your hands or feet are cold. You will actually warm them up. So it's really just lore, L-O-R-E, that leads me to cite that as an appropriate intervention in that circumstance. I am unaware that anybody's done research, because peripheral artery disease is the thing that most of the research is done, and that's large vessel disease, and I wouldn't expect niacin to do much for that directly, certainly not symptomatically. Now, with respect to the Alzheimer's research, that was a study that was done at UC Irvine recently, and they used a form of vitamin B3, nicotinamide, which is this very similar to niacin. It's niacin with an amine group. And they found that it helped prevent the accumulation of phosphorylated tau protein, which is the thing that leads to the development of neurofibrillary tangles. These are tangles literally in the axons of the neurons that interfere with axonal transport and lead to cell death. In this study, mice that were genetically predisposed to develop Alzheimer's disease were fed niacin, and then their long-term memories were tested. And the Alzheimer's mice did as well as normal mice when they were treated with niacin. So they did not develop evidence for their Alzheimer's in terms of behavior. And then when they, quote-unquote, sacrificed the animals, in other words, killed them and cut open their brains, they found that the niacin-treated animals had much lower levels of this tau protein in their brains. So their microtubules were healthier. This may be due to an antioxidant effect, and nicotinamide is very important in energy transport. Those of us who ever had to study oxidative phosphorylation may remember NADH and NAD. This is a electron donor that is very, very important in cellular physiology, and it is, in fact, made of niacin. So maybe making more of it is good for you, or maybe there's a different effect. The mechanism has not been elucidated here. And unfortunately, the dose of niacin is very much unclear. I don't have the original article here, so I don't know the dose that they used in the Irvine study. But even if you knew what the dose was and you extrapolated it up to humans, you know, milligrams per kilogram, it's not at all clear that that would be an appropriate dose for this purpose. We just don't know that much yet. I think that using niacin at the doses that we know to be effective for lowering triglycerides and therefore safe and effective would be a reasonable thing to do if you had early Alzheimer's disease, but it would be experimenting on yourself, and there would be no scientific justification for the action. You would really be extrapolating off of these very early animal studies. And you can make the argument that since niacin is not a dangerous agent, at least as long as you're monitoring liver enzymes and not taking a statin as well, that it would be a reasonable thing to try. And I wouldn't stand in the way of a patient of mine who wanted to do that. I would make sure, however, that we did a full disclosure and they understood that this was not scientifically validated and that this was a real leap of faith kind of intervention, not something that would be generally accepted as appropriate medical therapy for Alzheimer's. Let's go to Tony in Santa Cruz. Hello, Tony, and welcome to the program.
Hi, I've been dealing with some hip pain. And I'm 53, had five children, still have two teens at home. And I heard some information on one of your previous shows, kind of similar to what I have, where it's in my sacrum, especially my tailbone, it's really painful. And the pain goes down through my butt and down the back of my thigh and down into my calf a little bit. And it's constricting my movement to where it's hard for me to lift anything anymore, and I've tried to do some stretches, especially twisting my legs to the opposite side, and that seems to help. That was helping for a while, doing that three times a day. And then I was taking some fish oil, and you had said to take some osteobiflex and ibuprofen, so I was trying that for a while, and that worked for a little while. And now it seems like it's gotten worse, and my knee has swollen up, and my thighs feel like they're really thick and tight, but my left knee now, I can't really kneel on it. It's really painful. Now the exercises don't seem to work that well, and what does seem to work well is if I start the morning with a hot soak bath and then ice my knee or my hip and then take two Advils and then a cup of coffee. Then I almost feel normal.
It's quite a recipe.
Yeah.
How old are you?
53.
And do you bicycle?
No. And I've been going through menopausal stuff, and I know how to handle the hot flashes. I just never wear a turtleneck. I always wear V-neck shirts and not that much on top, and that seems to help me handle that part of it. And I haven't had a menstrual cycle for 2 years, so I think I'm coming out of it.
Okay, well, the first thing that I'm a little curious about is the connection between the hip and the knee, because I'm having trouble linking those two. Now, it's possible that you were walking in such a way because of the hip pain that you put additional stress on your knee, but I'd want that knee looked at, essentially, especially if there's swelling.
That's a new thing. In the last week it's happened.
And you said your thighs are tight,
especially in the back.
Are both thighs tight?
Mostly the left side.
Mostly the left. How about the feet? Are your feet swollen? Do you feel like the left foot is not fitting into its shoe properly?
No, the foot is okay.
Okay.
The back of the thigh is kind of tight. Everything's kind of tight.
Hmm.
And to bend down to pick up something off the floor is excruciating painful. I can't really do that. I can't lift anything anymore.
You mean you can't lift it from a squat?
Yeah. To squat down, or to squat to get down on the toilet, and then to get up from the toilet. Oh, my God.
Okay. And you're feeling this pain in the buttocks and in the sitter bone area, not on the front in the groin area. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, I'm concerned about these deep hip rotator muscles, some of the deep gluteal muscles, and also one called piriformis and one called obturator. And I wonder if you might have somehow gotten inflammation in either the tendon or the muscle, and now the muscle is actually squeezing your sciatic nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called piriformis syndrome. If you look it up online, you'll be able to read about it, and also there are some tests that you can look at and try them and see, oh yeah, that makes the pain worse. Things like turning your hip out and pushing against resistance and turning your hip in and pushing against resistance will help pinpoint whether it's one of the deep hip rotator muscles. I can figure out how that would work for the pain, the location of the pain, and the symptoms you're having as far as squatting and bending over. I'm at a loss as far as the knee is concerned, and I'm a little worried that their knee may be a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly some bursitis, maybe a housemaid's knee. I don't know if you kneel a lot, but sometimes people will develop knee bursitis. And unfortunately, going through menopause is an inflammatory state, and it does create some problems in terms of making people more susceptible.
Yeah, and I've gained a lot of weight while going through this menopause to where I'm like 40 pounds overweight now, and I think that's a factor too.
Oh, yeah, because you're loading things differently, and the knee itself, maybe you had a little meniscal injury, because when you get into your menopause, your tissues dry out. Unfortunately, everything kind of gets a little bit more rigid and a little bit more brittle. And that happens with age anyway, but it happens abruptly when the estrogen cuts off. And then it comes back a little bit towards normal. But you may have experienced a low-level meniscal tear, and that's why you have the swelling and the inflammation. I really think you need to get the knee looked at by a professional.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, thank you.
Good luck to you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Ellie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Speaking of knees, I'm going in a month for my second ACL reconstruction surgery.
Uh-oh. How old are
you? 22.
Volleyball?
Soccer.
Soccer. Okay, go ahead.
And the first tear was when I was 16, and it was completely torn, mm-hmm. and I tore 20% meniscus, and they were able to cut out the tear in the meniscus.
Yeah.
And since then, I think I retore it again when I was 17, and I've kind of been buckling it over the years ever since, and now I'm finally kind of shaping up and getting the surgery. However, this last time that I buckled it, I think I possibly tore more meniscus because the swelling lasted a lot longer than it normally does, and it was a lot more painful.
Yeah. Well, effectively, what happens in a buckle is, we call it a bucket handle tear. The meniscus is shaped kind of like think of it like a cereal dish, you know, with the kind of soup bowl or cereal bowl that has kind of a flat rim around the edge. And if you were to tear that rim such that it made a little flap, it was still connected on both sides, but there was a tear along the inside of the rim, then the edge could flip over And when that happens, it flips over and your joints immediately senses that. It goes, oh my God, it's flipped over, and it drops your knee. It just causes it to relax. It just relaxes all the muscles, and you can't bear weight on that knee. And when it drops like that, usually it creates essentially a bounce, and the fold will flip back out. So it'll flip back into place. But of course, in doing that, you have torn it a little bit. Every time you buckle a knee, there's the risk of tearing it. And if there's any inflammation afterwards, you probably tore it some more. And if you tear it a lot more, you get more inflammation. But it's really any time that that flap flips up and causes your knee to drop, there's the potential for tearing. So at this point, what they'll do is go in, find that tear, trim it, and plane it down. And your knee will stop buckling on you. You stop having the drop attacks, so to speak, with the leg. But you will have also lost cartilage, which means that you will develop arthritis earlier than you would have otherwise if you had never injured your knee. And at this point, the state of the art is such that there's nothing that we can do about it. We keep having promising breakthroughs on cartilage. That's been going on for about a decade, but we still haven't got the hang of rebuilding cartilage.
Okay, well, it sounds like I'll have to tough it out.
Well, I think the most important thing for you to do is do your rehab and really strengthen the knee. And then those rehab strengthening exercises, you get to do those every day for the rest of your life the way you floss.
Right.
Because you just don't want to blow out any more cartilage.
I was actually going to ask you of some preoperative suggestions. If there was, like, for instance, I worked a double shift yesterday at my work and it's sore. My knee itself is sore, and where I feel the soreness is in the back on the right.
Yeah. Okay, well, do you smoke?
No.
Okay, good. Because that would be number one pre-op suggestion is don't smoke. Number two is load up on protein, particularly gelatin. And I encourage people to do like soups, broths, basically meaty broths. So you take the carcass of the chicken and you boil it for 3 or 4 hours. And all of the collagen that's in that chicken will kind of melt and go into the soup. Here I am, you know, an MD with lots of letters after my name, and I'm prescribing chicken soup. But but actually, if you have the building blocks for cartilage in your system, when you go under the knife, you're going to heal better. So you really want to replete your body with protein building blocks. And the simplest way to do that is chicken soup. Basic, easy thing to do. Are you a vegetarian?
No.
Good. Okay, chicken soup. Every day for 2 weeks before the surgery. Make it yourself if you possibly can, because it'll have a lot more of the collagen breakdown peptides in it. Then you would be well advised to do leg strengthening. You don't want to hurt the cartilage, but doing like leg extensions and leg flexes with an ankle weight in a controlled situation so that you're not standing or squatting. You won't hurt the cartilage doing that. And you want to build those muscles up to be as strong as possible. You've got a couple of weeks before your surgery. You've got time to do it.
Now, I assume running is out of the question.
Running is out of the question. You want to run, get yourself a ski vest, like a water skiing vest, and go to a heated pool and run in the pool, in the deep end, with the vest on. And you can get all of the strengthening and all of the aerobics, but you absolutely will not hurt the knee.
Okay, great. And bike riding, is that safe?
It depends on the vigor with which you bike ride. I mean, if you're going up a 30 or 45% grade and pumping away with all your body weight onto your knee as you climb the hill, no, that's not good for your knee either. If you're doing like fast on a straightaway and, you know, built going for speed, that's okay.
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 And I'm sorry, are there any supplements that you would suggest taking at all?
At this point, pre-op, yeah, I would suggest a lot of calcium.
Okay.
And
calcium, magnesium,
yep. And you would probably also want to make sure you've got a lot of vitamin D coming in, because you won't absorb the calcium if you don't have the vitamin D in your system.
Exactly. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck with your surgery.
Hi. Thank you.
And do your rehab.
Okay.
Let's go to Julie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Julie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
You have a great voice.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm getting over a cold, so let's hope I don't cough too much.
Go ahead.
Actually, it may not be a cold. I came out of surgery, major surgery, about a month and a week ago, and that surgery was an exploratory laparoscopy where they did 3 incisions in my belly, and went in to try to figure out what was wrong with my ovaries or insides, because I've been dealing with intense pain and difficulty sitting, bending, lifting. The reason I actually called is I heard another gal talking about hip and leg pain. The fact is that they were not able to see inside me through the traditional ultrasounds, et cetera, internal and external. I do have a pelvic kidney. Yes, I do. That was discovered in an emergency surgery, which removed a dermoid cyst when I was about 17 years old.
All right, so not only do you have some developmental anomalies with the pelvic kidney, you also will have scar tissue from that first surgery.
And that's what the surgeon thought, and I think she did a fantastic job, but she found not only scar tissue, she found other adhesions and a little endometriosis and, of course, another cyst on my left ovary, which, although I'm not young, and I heard you say it's harder to get pregnant after, you know, 45, I would still like to be a mom, even in these challenging times. I'm hopeful for our future. So she did not remove the left cyst on the left ovary. It was biopsied. It is not cancer. Now, my concern and the reason I'm calling you is that I felt immediately different, but you have to acknowledge this was election night as well when I woke up from surgery. So I was in a state of real high energy and moving around a lot. I'm not someone who sits well or rests well, and that may be partly because of another complicating element, which is that I'm someone who has survived electrocution, and therefore my nervous system is quite different from the average person. And it's quite hard to stay still, to lie down. Plus, I'm formerly an athlete. So all of that together, my main concern right now is that I'm having bloating, not bloating really, not as if it's gas. It's like the air from the surgery, I think, is gone, but I'm still very thick, swollen feeling through the middle, and I keep feeling like my organs are falling down. I feel like, I mean, I'm on my feet a lot because I'm not a resting kind of person, but I feel like gravity is pulling my organs down, and I also feel a rough, almost like I can feel the nets that were placed around my organs. But now the belly button line down to my pelvic bone is especially hurting, and that left ovary is hurting. And right now I'm having a hard time getting an appointment with my doctor before the end of the year.
Okay. And when was your surgery?
It was November 4th.
Okay. And you're 45?
47.
47. And when was your last period?
It was about 4 days after the surgery.
So you're actually a little bit late.
Yeah. Let's hope I'm pregnant, but at the same time...
Mm-hmm. Have you done a pregnancy test?
No, I...
Well, okay.
I think I miscarried a lot before this surgery.
Maybe, but if your period's late, okay, and you aren't using contraception, and you have a change in your body, I don't care whether it's headaches, nausea, ringing in your ears... If you're a fertile-aged female and your period's late and your body feels funny, get a pregnancy test.
Okay.
It's, you know, the no-brainer thing that we're always hitting ourselves in the forehead. Why didn't I think of checking a pregnancy test, or why didn't I get a menstrual history? Mm-hmm. I've made that mistake so many times and gone down the wrong path trying to figure out something that's very simple and actually a very desirable outcome. Basically, what you've told me, Julie, is about your prior issues and your anatomy and things like that. Is I would anticipate that pregnancy is going to be quite a ride in terms of changes and odd feelings and maybe some unpredictable stuff. And it'll be a ride, but at the end of that, you're going to have a baby, and that's what you want. So you'll put up with it, and you'll deal. I know that.
Mm.
So I kind of hope you're actually pregnant. That would be great.
So do I. So,
sometimes, you know, when you mess with things, it's you get a surprise. But you've got other things going on. It could be your endometriosis has flared. It could be that
she said that she cut and burned and cleared that out.
Yeah, but when they do that, when they do a cut and burn, there's debris left in the abdomen that can take a couple of months to reabsorb.
Oh, I see.
So that could account for some of the oddness. This thing you say about feeling like your insides are falling out, that sort of sense of a pelvic relaxation, it's a symptom that's very much a Chinese medicine symptom for deficiency of in the spleen meridian. And it's like, oh, gosh, I wonder what's going on with your Chinese pulses. I wish I could take your pulses right now and see what your spleen pulse was doing.
Do you want me to take them now? I'm actually a Jin-Chin Do practitioner.
Yeah, check your spleen pulse. That's cool. I've never had anybody be able to do that on the phone before.
I know. You do have to listen, but with your fingers, so yeah. It's a little easier. My pulses really run very strong and thick anyway, and it's true I haven't checked them since surgery because everything is so weird right now.
Yeah. I'm betting there's going to be a very big difference between your spleen and your liver pulse on the opposite side. I'm going to just keep talking.
Bladder and kidney are just like roaring over here. Let's see. And the other thing is, I mean, I know the first week when I could just barely move, I couldn't get up and down myself alone.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I spent a little bit more time stretched out, but the reality is that my mind is very quick and constantly working, and
yes,
my body is constantly trying to catch up. Now, my pulses are all excessive right now. I can tell you that for sure.
Okay. Let me just
and
say...
And I haven't had any coffee either.
Yeah, let me just say, potentially a post-operative complication, even though you're a month out from surgery. I'm not going to be able to answer this for you, but I do have an answer for you, which is that it is absolutely your surgeon's responsibility to evaluate you, and do not let yourself be fobbed off by the front desk. I don't care if the doctor's busy. Somebody is covering for the doctor if the doctor is out of town. You should be checked by a gynecologic surgeon and evaluated, possibly have another ultrasound. I don't like your symptom complex, and you do need to do that pregnancy test. But this is not
even with just a 5-day lateness?
Yeah, if you feel different. Okay. And it'll be positive if you're 5 days late, and then a first morning urine will probably be positive if you're pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to pursue this and be a little bit more aggressive about making sure complications from your surgery, a late complication, is ruled out.
Because it is strange that it's more sore than it was, say, 2 weeks ago. And
exactly.
I wondered if I might have a little bit of an infection going on because there's a little bit of itchiness, but mostly it's this sometimes very sharp, sometimes just soreness from the belly button down.
Yeah.
And at first the entry wound incision of the belly button was
painful. It could be an infection. It could be a late complication. The first thing you want to do is make sure that it's not one of those, because those can be dangerous.
What is a late complication?
Well, it could be anything from a sponge left inside you to a post-op infection to a leaking blood vessel to, you know, you want the list? The list is going to scare you to death. So,
well, is when they do laparoscopy, there are sponges and all that go in?
Well, no, you're right. There's no sponges.
No, but the only reason I ask you, I'm sorry,
but
is
there's sutures.
I have... There's sutures?
There can be. If it depends on what they do. If they tie, they can tie things off.
I can't put my pants with zippers on. Drive me nuts. It's almost like
Julie
tinfoil and teeth.
Julie, go to the doctor's office and sit there till they see you.
Oh, wow.
Okay? You'll get seen. If only because they don't want to look bad to everybody else in the waiting room. Okay? You don't have to be that aggressive, but I would definitely start with talking to the office manager. Use the magic words, I think I may have a late surgical complication and I want to be seen. That should take care of it.
Okay.
Okay?
Do we have time for one more quick question?
I am afraid not. We're done, but I would love to talk with you next week and find out how things came out. So how about we make
a date
and you call back?
Wonderful, I will.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Dawn.
You're welcome. Yep, we've come to the end of another hour. It's hard to believe, and thank you for all of your calls and questions, and keep those emails coming at askdrdawn.com. And it's such a beautiful day, I'm going to go out and take a power walk. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.